So that's why as a church we want to wade into these issues. You're like, that's so dumb. Why are you doing this? That's why we want to wade into these next 7 weeks, because the question is really that comes up, well, why would we do a 7-week series on landmine issues? Why would we spend 7 weeks as a church talking about homosexuality and the transgender phenomenon and premarital sex? Like, why even bother walking into that hailstorm of opposing ideas? So let me explain to you why we are doing this for a couple of reasons, just by way of introduction to this series. This 7-week series is not to push an us versus them mentality. We're not interested as a church to simply throw out insults or call names or just kind of push people away who we disagree with. So right out of the gate, I need to say that the church and Christians have done an absolutely terrible job of engaging our culture with topics like this. Just an abysmal job. The church has, unfortunately, and lots of Christians have, treated homosexuals or transgender people just awfully. And not really representing Jesus or the gospel well at all. Like, Christians have done immense damage in treating homosexuals or treating transgenders or other people that we disagree with as almost like second class citizens, or they're dirty, or they're not quite, you know, good enough to come in. So we don't welcome them into the church, and we don't love them like Jesus would love them. And I'm not just talking like hypothetically. Like, that's happened even here, where it's kind of like, oh, they're here? And I hear comments like, do you know what they're like? Like, what if they brainwash our kids or what? And we treat people awfully. So this series is not designed, and this is not going to be, you know, a place where we just throw stones and we rank people as worse than others, or we question, you know, why are you here and why are you here? Now, on the flip side of that, oftentimes, Christians can just go into ostrich mode. And I actually had to look that up this week. I was like, what is the bird that sticks its head in the sand? I just completely, peacock, blue jay, I'm like, what is it? It's an ostrich. But, you know, they bury their heads in the sand. And oftentimes, that's the response. You know, on one side, we have Christians who, you know, I'm going to treat people terribly and throw stones and bash people. Or we have Christians that go, I'm just going to stay out of it. I'm just going to bury my head in the sand, not talk about it. If someone at work asks me, well, what is your opinion on this? I don't have an opinion. I just don't want to get involved. I don't want to offend people. I don't want to argue about things. Or even worse, what we see often is churches or Christians then say, well, times are changing, so let's just not push back against culture. Let's just accept this change to the definition of sexuality and gender and marriage. You know, we don't want to ruffle feathers. We don't want to cause tension. So let's just kind of ignore it or accept it. Now, we don't want to fall in either of those camps. We don't want to be a place where we just bash people and don't love them. And also, we don't want to be a place where we just bury our heads in the sand and refuse to engage. So that being said, this next 7 weeks, this series is an attempt to just ask and answer, what does the Bible actually say about sexuality and gender? What do Christians believe when it comes to homosexuality and transgenderism and sex before marriage and on and on? So really, this series is asking, well, what is a Christian worldview of sexuality? And more than that, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, this series is to equip you to say, well, how then do I talk to, you know, these are hypothetical, how do I talk to my homosexual neighbor about Jesus without just getting shut down because of a caricature of Christians? How do I engage my culture? How do I love and serve and share the gospel with, you know, my transgender brother? How do I do that? So we want this series to equip you to love and care for people that you disagree with. And so you need to hear, much of what Christians believe differs from what our culture believes. But oftentimes, I don't think it's what we say, I think it's how we say it. And so contrary to popular belief, it's actually possible to disagree with someone and still love them and pursue relationship and friendship with them. That is possible. Like, for goodness sakes, has anyone been married more than a week? That's possible for you to love someone and still disagree with them. You're allowed to laugh. You're sitting next to your spouse. Oh, that's not us, sweetie. You're allowed to laugh. It's possible. You can actually love someone and completely disagree with them. Now, here's the thing. That's the definition of tolerance. Tolerance means I disagree with you, yet for the sake of our relationship, I'm going to tolerate that disagreement and that difference of opinion. And yet we live in a day and age where culture has redefined what tolerance is. And so our culture says, well, tolerance is acceptance and approval. So if you don't accept me and approve of everything that I do and think and say, well, you're being intolerant. Well, but that's not the definition of tolerance. So it is actually possible to disagree with people and yet still love them and be civil and care for them. And so I am well aware that no matter what, in a series like this, anytime, you know, the church or Christians give pushback to our cultural agenda or cultural beliefs, we run the risk of just automatically being labeled as intolerant, homophobic, transphobic, bigoted. But I got to say, it's worth the risk talking about these things because we believe that the Bible actually has the answers for many of these diverse and hard issues in our culture. So a couple of housekeeping items, and then we want to dive into our topic this morning. If you want to go to that next slide, you're going to notice as we kind of walk through these next few minutes, there's a number at the bottom of each slide. That's our church texting number. I was gonna put Pastor Don's number up there just to, so he gets flooded with texts. But that is our church texting number. And so throughout this series, if we're talking and I'm up here and I'm teaching and you're going, well, wait, well, what about this? Or you didn't really explain that well enough. And a question comes up, you can right away just text that number 778-400-4549. Text your question to us, and then in the last week of our series, week 7. We're having a Hot Seat Sunday where Pastor Don and myself, we are just going to try and answer as many questions as we can. Now, some of you are like, I have a landline. What is texting? Hopefully you're not like that. But we have old-fashioned pen and paper at the Welcome Center. And so afterwards, if you're going, okay, that question, I just have a question that I need answered, you can just write that out. And there's a little box there and you can put it in. And really, we just want to answer as many questions that you have as possible. Also, tomorrow, so every Monday, there's going to be additional teaching material loaded onto our Vimeo account and the church website, because Don and me just went, man, there's just way too much to talk about in 45 minutes. So we've created these additional teaching videos that you can watch as a life group or as a family or on your own. And there's also life group questions. Basically, we want to just flood you with as much information as possible so that you can just dig into this stuff throughout the week as well. So all that being said, where do we start? In a series on homosexuality, on gender, on sex, where do you begin? And really, I believe, and what we're going to talk about tonight is we need to begin by asking, well, what does it mean to be human? And connected to that question is, well, where did we come from? Why are we here? What is our purpose of being on planet Earth? So really, the foundation of any topic connected to humanity or our sexuality is, well, what does it mean to be human? And the question of our humanity and our purpose is massive. Everybody at some point in their life, and more than likely at many moments in life, whether you are a Christian or an atheist or a Muslim or a Buddhist, everyone asks, what is the point? Why am I here? What is my purpose? If you see a middle-aged guy who's just dyed his hair and he's driving a sports car, he's asking that question. Why am I here? What is my purpose? That's called a midlife crisis, right? But everybody at some point in life is going to ask that. What is my purpose? Why do I exist? Why am I here? And connected to that question of what it means to be human are many questions related to, well, what do we do with our bodies? Now, the main worldview in our culture in Canada is this idea of secular humanism or naturalism. Essentially, the thinking is, well, the physical world exists and nothing else. So there is no spiritual world, there is no God, there is no creator. The only thing that exists is what you can see and touch and smell, right? The five senses. Only the physical. And how we came about was by accident. Billions of years ago, there was nothing. And then, boom, the Big Bang happened. And out of nothing came everything. And then through this process, this is our culture's worldview of natural selection and billions of years of evolution, here you are now, by chance, by accident. So in that type of worldview, there is no purpose in life. There is no greater meaning. There is no life after death. There is no eternity. You're born and you live and then you die. And there's nothing greater beyond that. And so you go, man, that sounds bleak. It's because it is bleak. There's just no meaning, just pure chance and accident. Now, in a worldview like that, so if that's true, if our culture's worldview is true, that, you know, billions of years ago, by accident, we're all here, evolution, natural selection, there's nothing beyond your, whatever, 70, 80 years of living that you have. If that's true, well, then who cares what you do with your body? If there's no creator and we just live in a universe of chance and randomness, then actually there's no worth or dignity in being human. So in reality, if that worldview is true, well, have sex with whoever you want, man, woman. And even if you go far enough down that road, if you follow that worldview to its natural conclusion, man, woman, child. And right away, our culture balks at that, and they go, oh, no, whoa, 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 that is wrong, we would never say that. But that's naturally where that worldview leads. Who cares? If there's no worth or dignity or any type of value to humanity, because we're all here by accident, take that to its natural conclusion. That's the kind of worldview that leads to racism, sexism, genocide. I mean, Hitler believed in a naturalistic worldview. He was a Darwinian. He believed in this view of humanity that we're here by chance and there's no point. And so that led him to kill 6 million Jews. They're not a part of the preferred race and they're a drain on resources. So if humanity has no worth or value and we're here by accident with no metaphysical purpose, meaning no purpose beyond just the physical, well, then who cares how we treat other ethnicities? Who cares how we treat the opposite sex? It's all randomness and pointless anyways. Now, coupled with that, with our culture's view of naturalism and evolution and how the universe came to be, what we're seeing is this elevation of the autonomous individual. What that means is that we have elevated you as the individual to the highest possible level. So it's all about what you need and what you want and what you feel as an individual. Now, interestingly enough, this line of thinking actually began 1600 years ago with, funny enough, the church father Augustine. And Augustine, in his writings, he actually veered away from this idea of, well, the community is most important. And he actually wrote that, well, what's most important is inward. It's your feelings, it's your convictions, and it's your longings. That's most important when it comes to being human. Now, many years later, René Descartes, he's a Christian philosopher, he said, well, actually, what it means to be human is your mind. And if you know the phrase that he coined, I think, therefore I am, he said, what makes you human is your ability to think. Then Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who's a non-Christian philosopher, he said, well, actually, the essence of being human is the autonomous reasoning individual can be improved, by self-acceptance and self-love. So don't look outwardly for meaning or identity, but rather what every individual should do is just look inwardly. Love yourself, accept yourself. That is what is most important. Then the influential American psychologist William James built on that, and he said, well, actually, the autonomous reasoning individual, yes, can be improved by self-acceptance and self-love, but it needs to be aided by psychology. So I just love that. What a racket. A psychologist says, actually, you need to be aided by psychology. So come and I'll help you. But it was this idea that, yes, you need to self-actualize and love yourself, but you need help from someone else to do that. And then lastly, Abraham Maslow, an American psychologist, he said, self-actualization is the defining principle of what it means to be human. So he says, you want to know what it's like to be human? It's you just self-actualizing. Fulfilling your dreams, your destiny, finding yourself, loving yourself, that is the most important thing, and that's what it means to be human, what feels good and what makes you happy. So that's the worldview that we see lived out. When it comes even to issues of homosexuality, transgenderism, premarital sex, promiscuity, if the worldview is, well, the universe is by accident, you are here by accident, there's no higher purpose or meaning in life, there is no afterlife, and being human means just you are an autonomous individual finding your purpose and self-actualization and happiness within yourself, that's where we're at as a culture. It's all about you as an individual loving yourself and pursuing what makes you happy. And if that worldview is true, then that makes sense. If all you have is 70 or 80 years and there's nothing else, well then sure, why wouldn't you do that? Now, in stark contrast to that worldview is the Christian worldview or the biblical worldview. And in Genesis chapter 1, we actually read about God creating the universe. The Bible teaches that you are not here by accident. The universe didn't just accidentally happen. The Bible teaches that there's actually a creator outside of creation. And we're not going to read all of Genesis 1, but it records for us the act of God creating everything, and then we reach the pinnacle of God's creation, which is humanity. So Genesis 1:26, this is what it says. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them, and God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So a couple of fascinating things that we see here. God creates the universe, and the pinnacle of his creation, his crowning act, is humanity. God creates men and women, male and female, in his image. And the theological term for that that comes from Latin is the Imago Dei. It's the doctrine of the fact that we are made in the image of God. And so this gives humanity incredible worth and dignity and meaning and purpose. The Imago Dei gives us a profound sense of significance. Now, we're going to get into what being made in the image of God means. But before we do that, notice that in verse 26, God says, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." So there's plural language being used here. And what we see in this first chapter of the Bible is a revelation of the nature of God existing as a community of persons, otherwise called in Christianity the doctrine of the Trinity. So the Bible teaches that there is one God who eternally exists as three persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and each person is fully God, and yet we serve one God. Confused? Good. That means that I'm teaching it correctly. Because any type of teaching about the nature of God and his existence as a triune God that seeks to remove any confusion or mystery usually ends up being false teaching. Because there's an element of God and his existence and his nature that with our finite minds we just cannot fully comprehend. So as you think about God existing as the Trinity, there should be just a point that you get that you go, man, that is just too far. I just cannot fully understand that. And I would say, well, that's good. You're on the right track. God exists as a community of persons, and we see this reflected. God says, "Let us, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, make mankind in our Father, Son, Holy Spirit image." Now, the fact that God exists as a community, as a Trinity, has profound implications when it comes to being made in his image as male and female. And we're going to return to that point later. So the Christian worldview of the Imago Dei, of being made in the image and likeness of God, gives worth and value to humans that no other worldview gives. It means that your life has significance and value. You were created for a purpose. We were created to image God and to have dominion over his creation. So think about that. Animals are not created in the image of God. Only humanity is. And so we see God creating everything in Genesis 1 just by speaking things into existence. So Genesis 1 is kind of like the 50,000-foot view of creation. And then if you actually read Genesis 2, it's almost like this. Now we're going to zoom in, and it's this second account of how God created humans. And so in Genesis 1, we see God just speaking things into existence. But then in Genesis 2, we're told that God actually forms the man from the ground. And then breathes life into him. So there is something unique and special about humanity. So what does it mean then to be made in God's image? Is it a physical thing? Is it the fact that we have souls? Is it this, you know, spiritual aspect of humanity? Is it our minds that we can reason and we can feel emotion and we can think critically? I don't think that we can necessarily just narrow down being made in the image of God to one solitary thing, because every way that mankind is like God is part of mankind being in the image and likeness of God. So yes, our morality is an aspect of us being made in the image of God. We have morality. We have a moral compass. We know right from wrong. We, like, if you go to Save-On after this service tonight and you see a man, you know, kick an old lady over and steal her groceries, you wouldn't just go, "Ah, sucks to be her, I'm going to drive." You would say, "That is wrong. That man shouldn't have done that. That's stealing. That's assault. That is wrong." So we have morality. Now, animals don't have that. Like, lions don't go to jail for killing a gazelle. "Ah, 10 to life now. I saw you kill." That just doesn't happen. There is no moral compass in the animal kingdom. There is no morality there. That is a distinct thing of being human. So morality is part of our being made in the image of God. The fact that we are spiritual beings, that's a part of being in the image of God. We have spirits. There's more than just the physical realm. We're told in Scripture that God is spirit. We're told that in John 4:24. And so an aspect of being made in the image of God is that we have a spiritual aspect to us. Our mentality is an aspect of being made in the image of God. Yes, we have minds that we can think critically and we use reason and logic and deduction. We use our minds. And I've used this example before, and I used it this morning. Like, I have a cat, Coco, and he doesn't sit outside on the back porch at night gazing at the moon wondering what his purpose in life is, right? Coco doesn't go, "Why am I here? What is my purpose in life?" And Coco doesn't gather than other neighborhood cats and say, "Come on over tonight, we're going to have some catnip, and we're going to talk theology." That doesn't happen. And someone was like this week, "Well, are you sure that doesn't happen?" I am sure that doesn't happen. They, like, no other animal in the animal kingdom uses deduction and reasoning and critical thinking. That is unique to humans. It's part of being made in God's image. The fact that we're relational is an aspect of being made in the image of God. God created us in his image, and God exists as a community of persons. And so our relational nature is a part of imaging God. We love being in community. We love being in relationship with others. I mean, some of us more than others, but I mean, we love having people over and just developing deep relationships with people. I mean, that's why marriage is so incredible, because it's this man and this woman who are a part together of imaging God in their relationship. So then we can go even further, though, and say, well, how do we specifically image God? And all you have to do is think of some of the character traits of God. Well, God is holy. So when you and I hate sin and love holiness, we are imaging our Creator. God is love. So we mirror and we image God when we love Him and we love others, when we love our enemies, when we love those who don't love us back. God is truthful, so we mirror and image God when we believe biblical truths over lies. God is righteous, so we mirror and image God when we fight oppression and injustice and evil. God is merciful, so we mirror and image God when we forgive those who sin against us. God is beautiful, so we image God when we create and we enjoy beauty in a holy way. I mean, God is creative. We see that in the creation account. And so when you and I are creative and we create art and music and all of these things, we are imaging the fact that we have a creative God. So we're created as God's imagers. We function as God's representatives on earth. And I don't think that we can just narrow it down to one quality within human beings, because the defining feature of what it means to be human is that we're God's image bearers. So remember, right? Psychologists say the defining feature of what it means to be human is self-actualization. And the Bible would say, actually false. The defining thing of what it means to be human is that you're an image bearer. Now, it's scary because lots of Christians in the church, they've actually bought into the psychology view rather than the biblical view. And so that's why we see lots of Christians who are, it's all about finding myself and loving myself, and I just got to self-actualize, and God is some distant, he wants what's best for me, your best life now, and I just need to love myself more and just realize more of who I am. And the Bible doesn't say anything about that. It says, what is the most defining thing about being human? You're an image bearer. The Imago Dei is a massive privilege. No other creature in all of creation is said to be created in the image of God. Not even angels, we're told, are created in the image of God. Only humanity. And so it gives us worth and dignity and value and purpose, but it also means it matters terribly what we do with our lives and with our bodies. See, our culture's worldview, again, is, well, you're an autonomous individual, you're your own person, whatever you want for yourself goes. And in a naturalistic, secular worldview, why wouldn't that be the case? But the biblical worldview is actually, there's a creator above you, you are not your own. And so if we are created and there is a creator, then naturally it means, well, that creator has the right to give guidelines to his creatures. And so we're going to see in the weeks to come, some of those guidelines exist, those parameters and those guidelines around sexuality and gender and marriage. And listen, it's not for your disappointment and frustration. So often we view that, we go, man, God is a killjoy. Like, right? He just puts all these rules and boundaries around sexuality and gender, and we go, it's just awful. What we don't understand is that God, yes, puts boundaries and parameters around sexuality and marriage and gender, not for your disappointment, but for your flourishing, because he's God and you are his creation. So we have to get it into our minds that when we talk about marriage and gender and homosexuality and premarital sex and all of these things, God's not out to get you. God's not saying, I'm just going to make them miserable. God knows better than you, and he wants you to flourish as his image bearer. So the biblical worldview is that humanity matters, that we're created in the image of God, which gives the human race dignity and worth and value and purpose. Now, I want to give you 9 takeaways or realizations, whatever you want to call it. 9, you know, if we are made in the image of God, here are 9 realities or 9 takeaways or 9 realizations of that. Some of you are like, 9 of them? Don't worry, we're going to go fast through these. But 9 realizations of the fact that we are created in God's image. If that's true, this is what it means. So first of all, the first realization that we have to get right is that we're created by the Trinity. God eternally exists as a community of persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and we're created in his image. And so that means, contrary to our culture's belief, you are not simply an autonomous individual trying to self-actualize, trying to just seek self-fulfillment. You were created by a triune God, a God who exists in community. So you were created as an image bearer for relationship, a relationship with God, relationship with others, and relationship with the environment that you live in. God created you for relationships. We are created in the image of a triune God. Secondly, God gave something of himself to us. We are people of transcendence. There is more to life than just the physical. There is more beyond what you can just smell and taste and hear, and like more beyond your five senses. God is spiritual, and there is a spiritual realm. And so part of what it means to be made in God's image is that we're people of transcendence. There's a metaphysical, so beyond the physical realm aspect of what it means to be human. Thirdly, being made in the image of God does not make us little gods. We are not absolutely like God. We resemble him. And even the words in Hebrew, if you read verse 26, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Even the Hebrew words for image and likeness, and I'm not a Hebrew expert, but tselem and demut, that actually means something that is similar but not identical. Both of those words mean the same thing. It's something that is similar but not identical. And so we are created beings. We're not gods. There are attributes we share with God, and we share them imperfectly. And then there's attributes that belong to God alone. God is sovereign. God is all-knowing. God can be present everywhere. God doesn't change. God is eternal. He had no beginning. And so you think about you as a human, you had a beginning. You can't be everywhere. You aren't all-knowing. And so there are attributes of God that are God's alone. So we have to have this proper understanding. Like, on one hand, lots of people say, oh, human beings are worthless, they're garbage, they're worth nothing. That's not true. And yet, on the other hand, the temptation is to go, hey, maybe we're supposed to be like little gods. Because even think about what was the downfall of humanity in Genesis chapter 3. What was the temptation? It was that. Satan came, and what did he say to Adam and Eve? And this is my paraphrase, but he said, God's holding out on you. Don't you know that you can be like God? Now, it's fascinating because Adam and Eve were already like God. They were in his image, and yet Satan tempted them and said, you know what? God's holding out on you. You can be God. So the temptation can be, well, if I'm made in the image of God, I must be pretty great. Maybe I'm almost like a little God. So we have to have a proper understanding. We're created beings. You're not worthless, but you are not a little God. God is high above you. Fourthly, being made in the image of God makes us unique and distinct and valuable. There's something unique about humanity. We are the exception of creation. There's something in us that is exclusive to us. Again, like animals are not made in the image of God. Plants and trees and mountains are not made in the image of God. And some of you are like, ah, but I just love my dog and I love my cat. That's great, but they're not made in the image of God. Right? My girls are like, hey, is Coco going to be in heaven? Probably not. You can be nicer than that. But there's something unique to humanity, and it makes humanity distinct from all of creation. It also makes humanity valuable, innately valuable. Listen, there is nothing worth more in the cosmos than humans. You are intrinsically valuable. Listen, you're not God, but you're also not worthless. Human life is valuable, it is sacred, and it's important to note that the image of God, this innate valuableness, is true regardless of your stage of development. So there is no, you know, incremental or partial image of God. Someone who is an adult is not more of an imager of God than a newborn. Someone who is disabled or severely handicapped is not made less in the image of God. That's why Christians are just opposed to worldviews and thoughts and actions that demean human life. That's why abortion is wicked and evil. It is killing an unborn baby made in the image of God. That's why physician-assisted suicide is wrong. It is murdering someone who is made in the image of God, a fellow image bearer. And oftentimes in our culture, abortion and physician-assisted suicide, it's packaged and it's peddled as, well, you know, we're just being merciful and we're just being kind. It's not. It's demeaning. It's saying, well, that unborn child and that senior citizen and that handicapped person has less value and worth than us. So they're less the image of God than we are. They aren't worth as much than us as us. That's fundamentally false. The Bible says all human life is valuable and precious, regardless of the stage of life. I mean, I think about my wife is 20 weeks pregnant almost. That child in her womb is just as much made in the image of God as I am. It's not that I'm more made in the image because I'm 32 now and I've had longer life experience. And that child, you know, it has potential to be the image of God. That's not true. So human life is valuable and precious. Fifthly, being made in the image of God makes us a part of creation. We are unique and valuable in creation, but we're still a part of creation. And human beings are actually formed from creation. I find that really fascinating that when you read Genesis 2, it says that God actually took, you know, the dust of the ground and formed the first human being and then breathed life into them. So you are, like, human beings are actually formed out of creation itself. That stands in sharp contrast to the cultural view where we just kind of evolved over billions of years from other species. Not created, but just, you know, random chance, natural selection, evolution over billions of years. And here we are. And so the line of thinking was, well, you know, well, look at the similarities, right? There's lots of similarities between us and apes or chimpanzees. So we had to come from the same ancestor. But you need to know that similarities between us and other parts of creation actually doesn't suggest a similar ancestry. It suggests a shared creator. Because the thing is, chance doesn't create similarities. Chance does the opposite. Chance brings randomness. Do you know what creates similarities? A creator. Sixthly, being made in the image of God means that we were created for a purpose. Your life is not meaningless. Your life has purpose. You were created by God, and God, we're told, he makes humanity, and then he gives humanity dominion over his creation. He says, be stewards of it. So God makes us curious adventurers who, and he grants us permission to go and explore his creation. God wants us to be reproductive and to have children. And I mean, at this, I think there's like 14 women pregnant in our church. So I'm like, well, you're doing that part, right? You multiply. There you go. Way to go. But God says, fill the earth, multiply, have babies. God gives us meaningful work to do. I love in Genesis 2, it says God creates the man, and then he puts him in the garden to work it. So God actually created us to work. And so that's why all human endeavor and all enterprise has spiritual meaning. Work is actually a spiritual exercise. And don't believe the lie that lots of us, we say, well, yeah, but you know, the guy that goes to Africa to feed hungry kids, that's spiritual work. I mean, I'm just a bricklayer. Listen, it doesn't matter whether you're a baker or a bricklayer or a banker or you work in the oil field or whatever it is, all work is spiritual. It's what God designed you to do. And so actually when you work and you use your talents and your skills, you are imaging God by doing what he created you to do. We image God by working and keeping and caring for the planet, by creating culture and being creative with the arts and with our gifts. Our lives have incredible purpose and meaning because we are made in God's image. Seventhly, being made in the image of God means God's image is displayed in males and females. So to put it bluntly, gender matters. We see in this account that God creates males and females. Both are necessary. We need both male and female to display the likeness and image of God. Men and women are created equal, but different. So, like, listen, men are not like women, and women are not like men. We are different, and yet equality doesn't mean sameness. Like, we have the same worth, the same value, the same dignity, but God created men and women, male and female, differently. Gender matters. And the Bible teaches that God is the giver of it. We are not the identifiers of our gender. God is. And the choice belongs to God alone. And so that is why there is such contention around this whole transgender debate, because men and women have decided that they will be the deciders of what gender they want to be. And again, it's related to this idea of, well, I'm just self-actualizing and I'm loving myself and I'm fulfilling my own destiny. And so I want to be the one that decides what I do with my gender. So you need to hear, here's the thing. Masculinity and femininity matter, but there is ambiguity and fluidity to what masculinity and femininity look like. And I know right away when you say the word fluidity, everyone just kind of goes, bleh, because that's the word that is kind of talked about in our culture. But when it comes to masculinity and femininity, there is a certain amount of fluidity. So let me give you an example. There are girls who are tomboys, girls who don't like playing with dolls, and who don't like dressing up like princesses. And there's girls that I want to hunt and I want to fish and I want to fix cars. And conversely, there's boys who don't want to hunt or fish. And some people go, oh, blasphemy, not up here. There's boys that don't want to do that, who could care less about cars and say, hey, I want to pursue the arts and writing and poetry. Listen, that doesn't mean that they're the wrong gender. But that's what's said. Well, if you have a daughter that doesn't like wearing dresses and wants to play sports and fix cars, well, maybe she's actually a boy. And you have a son that doesn't like sports and hunting and fishing and wants to write poetry and pursue the arts, well, maybe your son's actually a girl. So here's the thing. You have to notice the hypocrisy of our culture. Our culture says, hey, we're just trying to get rid of gender stereotypes. And yet they're pushing very rigid gender stereotypes. Because they say, well, your girl doesn't like pink and wearing dresses, she must be a boy. That's a huge gender stereotype. So in the name of, hey, we're advancing and we're getting rid of stereotypes, they're just pushing very rigid gender stereotypes. So you need to understand that there is this spectrum of masculinity and femininity. I mean, for me, for example, like, I grew up with three sisters, wasn't really into, like, I have no interest in cars or hunting or fishing. And you're like, fire that man. Why is he up here? I don't have interest in, like, I love to read and I love to write and I love to do things. And so if I grew up in the world that we live in now, I would have been told by teachers and doctors, well, maybe, Andrew, you're actually a girl. You don't like these traditional boy things, so maybe you're not a boy. So listen, it's just ludicrous that we've bought into that line of thinking that, hey, you have to fit into this definition of masculinity or femininity, or maybe you're the wrong gender. Listen, there's a spectrum and fluidity with masculinity and femininity. There is not, that doesn't equal the fluidity to gender. It doesn't mean that a girl who likes to play rough and wear blue and hunt and fix cars is actually a boy. And it does not mean that a boy who likes to cook or paint or write poetry or doesn't like getting dirty in the mud, that doesn't mean that he's actually a girl. So again, we're going to dive more into this later in the weeks to come, but there is just so much hypocrisy in our culture's view of gender. I'll give you another example that just came to me. I mean, if you talk about the idea of gender and sex, people say, well, sex is assigned to you at birth based on your anatomy, and gender is what you feel inside. But listen, I've had two daughters and we're pregnant. Never in my life, when our daughters came out, the doctor didn't say, well, because of the presence of a vagina, I label this a female. He said, congrats, it's a girl. So you have to understand the hypocrisy. When we went for an ultrasound, the doctor said, would you like to know the gender? Not, would you like to label this fetus a male or a female? So again, we have to be able to call out some hypocrisy in our culture when it comes to this. And we're going to dive more into this later. But when a man rejects his maleness or a female rejects her femaleness, it's actually a symptom of a larger sin. It's rejecting the authority of God in your life. But again, in our culture, you as the autonomous individual seeking self-actualization, that is what is king in our culture. If there is no creator, well then just do whatever you want. But listen, any counsel that says do what you feel inside is really bad counsel. Because the reason is we're all broken inside. Every single human being is sinful and broken, the Bible teaches. So the counsel, if anyone gives you counsel, well, just do whatever you feel inside, that's terrible counsel. Because to define yourself out of your brokenness is dangerous. And again, I want to stress, we're all broken. Our brokenness just manifests itself differently. No one asks for how their brokenness shows up. But often the line of thinking is, well, do what you feel inside as long as you don't hurt anybody. But even that is wrong thinking. And I want to challenge that principle that, well, just because something doesn't harm anybody somehow takes it out of the realm of immorality. So for instance, here's an example. I could spend, and this is hypothetical, I could spend 50 years cheating on my wife. I could spend the next, until the day I die, I could have affairs and sleep with other women, and my wife might never find out about it. I could go to my deathbed with that secret, and in that case, I didn't harm her. And we would all say, that's wrong. Who cares if you didn't harm her, Andrew? If you slept around on your wife for your entire marriage, that's wrong. So the idea that, well, as long as you don't hurt anybody, it's magically fine, that's just not true. Like I said, we want to unpack more of this in the weeks to come, but suffice to say, being made in the image of God means, and we've seen, that it's displayed in male and female. Gender matters. Eighthly, being made in the image of God means we share the same parents. So aside from the, you know, catchy saying, there really is only one race, the human race. The Imago Dei, the doctrine of being made in the image of God, it leaves no room for racism because we all share the same parents. And so also I want to challenge us, you know, majority of us as, you know, white North Americans, we often read the Bible account and just assume that they're white. They're not. Many of us think, well, yeah, Jesus was white, right? Wrong. He was Middle Eastern. So if you read the account of Adam and Eve and just assume that they're white, you need to check yourself. But here's the thing. It actually doesn't matter because we all share the same parents. And lastly, being made in the image of God and everything we've talked about connected to that reminds us that something has gone wrong. Because we look around the world and we see brokenness and hurt and evil and injustice. And so we go, well, something's not quite right. And when you read the creation account, we read, well, God made everything perfect. There was no death. There was no sickness. There was no deformity. There was no darkness. And yet our world is broken. Many of our lives are broken. Our marriages are broken. Our sexuality is broken. And the Bible's answer for what went wrong is called sin. It's mankind's rebellion against their creator. It's us, the created, saying to the creator, well, we know better than you. We know how to run our lives better than you. We know how to do marriage better than you. We know how to raise our kids better than you. We know more about our sexuality than you do. Now, the incredible thing about the gospel and Christianity is that we don't actually have to stay in our brokenness. We know that we're made in the image of God, and yet because of sin, that image is broken. So if you think of it like a mirror, we're called to image God, to mirror God, but that mirror is cracked and shattered. And yet the good news of the gospel is Jesus is the perfect image of God. I mean, Colossians 1:15 says, He is the image, this is speaking of Jesus, of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. 2 Corinthians 4:4 says, In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Hebrews 1:3, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Even Jesus says this in John 12. He said, whoever sees me sees him who sent me. And in John 14, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So the beautiful thing is that Jesus, the Son of God, shows us what being in the image of God means. Jesus, fully God and fully man, lived a perfectly sinless life, and he perfectly imaged God. He did what none of us could do. So actually, the gospel of Jesus is what is needed for all of these issues pertaining to our sexuality that we're going to dive into over these next weeks. Jesus is the one who redeems us and restores us to be more like him. That's what it means to be truly human, to be image bearers. I mean, the Bible talks lots about this. Colossians 3 says, do not lie to one another, seeing that you've put off the old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge. And what does it say? After the image of its creator. 2 Corinthians 3 says the same thing. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. So the thing is, we're called as human beings to mirror and image God in the world. But because of sin and brokenness, it's like a mirror that's been shattered and broken. And the beauty of the gospel is that Jesus, through his grace and through the Spirit, bit by bit, causes the mirror of your life to be increasingly like Jesus. He begins to put back together your brokenness. So Christianity in our culture is characterized as, well, you just got to be good enough so you can go to heaven. That's not Christianity. Christianity is you can't be good enough. But Jesus was good enough, so believe in him. Not just for eternal life one day, but for the here and now, as God patiently picks up the broken pieces of your life and puts them back together. And oftentimes in our society, and I know in my own life, even when it comes to sexuality, it feels like we're just kind of smashing our own lives over and over as Jesus is trying to put them back together. But God is patient, and this process of transformation takes your whole life. But in the area of sexuality and homosexuality and transgenderism and premarital sex, the answer is not just to push into your brokenness and just act out what you feel. The answer is Jesus.